I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Mark Solomon, an M&A and private equity partner at Catton in Dallas and managing partner of the firm's office in that city. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
David, thanks so much for having me.
So we're going to talk about the evolution of your career on today's podcast, the development of family offices into institutions that look much more like private equity sponsors, what you're seeing in the M&A and private equity markets now, and then how you decompress from the job. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice of law.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, it's probably a typical story. Part of me always knew I wanted to be a lawyer, didn't know what it meant, but part of me always thought that's what I would do. At the same time, I'm from New York, and when I was growing up, my parents were divorced at a very young age, and I was close to both my father and my stepfather, so I was lucky that way. But they both had very different jobs. My dad was a commercial real estate broker, and my stepdad owned I'll call it a small to medium-sized record label. My dad and I would work with them both a lot over the summers. I had various roles in their organizations. And they were very different businesses. My dad's business was purely a transaction business. It was professionals, you know, business to business, waiting for a transaction to occur. And that was what his work was based on. Meanwhile, the record label was just totally different. It was the business of first creating good songs, then in those days, trying to figure out how your vinyl could be played on the radio legally, and then trying to sell it, distribute it. And then, of course, making the next song and maintaining the act. In those days, the whole idea of performance being a big aspect of music, it just wasn't the same. It was really more ancillary to just the sale of vinyl. And so in the course of that, I really came to appreciate just how there's different ways that businesses can operate, different ways that people can make money, and different ways they can be successful. And ultimately, I went through college, went to law school. When I applied to law school, I actually thought about getting an MBA. I took the GMATs at the same time as I took the LSATs. And I thought long and hard about it. And at the end, I just went to law school. And when I was there, the first year was difficult, like it is for everybody else. And part of it, I think, is because when you're first in law school, nothing's intuitive. The vernacular is different. You just don't really know what things mean, and everything takes a while. And then I took my corporate law class. And when I took that, it was the first time in law school that just everything made sense.
And did it make sense for you because you'd seen these issues and so they were real to you in a way that they aren't for students who haven't had the kinds of experiences with even small businesses that you had?
You know, I think about that, and it could be. If it's because of that, it was very organic. I didn't know what was happening. But just the concepts made sense, just the case law, all the outcomes, even some of the vernacular made sense. So it could very well be because I'd just been exposed to more things. So I took that, and it really solidified my idea. I really want to do corporate and transactional law. And then while I was in law school, I also took an internship at the SEC. And that really sharpened my focus even more. In part, it was at the SEC. I was also in enforcement, so it wasn't transactional, but just the professionalism that people at the SEC had and how much they cared about their jobs. You know, people look at government agency and sometimes they wonder, do these people really care? Do they work hard? These people did. I mean, they were bright. They taught me a lot. They worked hard. And when I came out of law school, I decided that's what I want to do. I want to be a corporate lawyer. I want to see some capital markets work. I didn't know that much about M&A yet, but I knew that's what I wanted to do.
And so you graduated from law school in 1985, which was a pivotal year in the history of corporate law. It was the year that three cases that are still foundational in Delaware were decided. It was the height of the hostile takeover wave. It was when private equity buyouts were becoming larger and larger and larger. And you started your career and you spent your whole career in Dallas. So talk about the decision to go to that market. And then what the practice was like there in the 1980s. And of course, it changed dramatically in that decade.
It really did. Yeah, so I went to law school in Washington, D.C., and I thought long and hard about going back to New York. But people forget that, you know, in 1985, and also, as you know, when you're going through law school, you're really looking at your permanent employment in your first and second year of law school was 1982, 1983. You know, New York almost went bankrupt in the late 70s. It was a different city in the early 80s and even to a degree in the mid 80s than it was 10 years later. It was still wonderful, still a lot going on, but the opportunity that is there now was not the same at that time period. Meanwhile, when I was in law school, Dallas and Texas at the time was booming, at least in the early 80s. Oil prices were rising. It was an economy that people were hiring left and right. And I just had a great opportunity to go to a law firm in Dallas that at that time represented the Hunt family. And it was almost all of the Hunt families. At that time, it was the fourth or fifth largest law firm in Dallas. They were doing great work all over the world. They were doing tender offers. They were doing large M&A transactions. And they really were looking for somebody that had a business background. And to me, it was just sounded perfect. I'll be honest, when I took the job, I didn't know if I'd stay more than 2 or 3 years. 40 years later, here I am. But it was a great, great opportunity.
And the Hunts were, I mean, that was a family that showed up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, not just the front page of the business section, the front page of the paper in the 80s. That was, you know, an extraordinarily prominent, wealthy family.
Right. And they still are. They're still very prominent. They're still very active. One of my partners actually still to this day represents one of the families and has for the last 40 years. And so they still are very prominent. But back then, when I first arrived at the firm, they were the wealthiest family in the world. They did things everywhere.
And so in the late 80s, the economy in Texas changed dramatically when you had effectively a crash in energy prices. And then you had the savings and loan crisis, which together with that impact on the energy markets put Texas in a deep, deep recession for a number of years. So, you know, this happens when you're a young associate. So one, how did that affect your practice? And then two, just thinking about your career, you know, how did you think about managing your career so that you could work your way past this?
Right, right. It's really a great point because basically, as soon as I arrived, things changed. Oil prices crashed. And in those days, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about how the energy world is different now, but in those days, it really was oil and gas. And when the price of oil crashed, economies went with it. And you're exactly right. The savings and loan crisis occurred. And those two factors just really hit all of Texas, particularly Dallas, but all of Texas very hard. So it went from being an extremely vibrant economy with deals galore to one that contracted rapidly. I bought a house in 1986 where you would have thought, my gosh, I assumed a mortgage for 9 7/8%. 8 years later, I came to closing with a check for a quarter of the price I bought it for. That's how bad things were. It took a long time for Texas to cycle out of that. So yeah, it was very slow. The first firm I was with dissolved. Firms were dissolved, I'd say, in Texas once every 2 or 3 years, large firms. It was a difficult time. But what you did learn, I guess, a couple of things. One was I started working with a group of lawyers that I still work with today. And that, I think, has been one of the most gratifying parts of my career, that we've all worked together this whole time, all the way through. And I think part of it's, you know, you work long hours, you know, you're up out there, you're in the trenches late at night, you're working, you don't have a lot of control over your personal schedule as a young lawyer, but there are these group of lawyers that are with you there. And, you know, we forge relationships that, you know, have stayed with us to this day. But it was a difficult time. You learned the value of treating clients right. You learn the value of relationships, how important they really are, and doing whatever you can to make sure that, you know, as a service provider, you're always the person that the client wants to call. You're always a person that's giving the best advice and giving it promptly.
And so talk about the evolution of your practice over the 90s. And then after the dot-com bust, which on one level would not seem to have affected Texas all that much, but on another level marked a radical shift in the capital markets, effectively from public capital to private capital, that's affected all of big law.
You're exactly right. Because as you know, in the legal markets back, you know, before 2000 were a lot more localized. And what we saw in Texas, as we started to come out of the savings loan crisis and the energy bust, is we saw a lot of capital markets transactions. I'd say for the first 15, 20 years of my career, I was more of a capital markets lawyer than an M&A lawyer. We saw a ton of transactions. We saw internet transactions. We saw a lot of wireless transactions. Telecom was very big at the time. There was just a lot of activity together with traditional industry, but there was a lot of capital markets activity, a lot of M&A activity for public deals. And so we saw that a lot. Then when the dot-com bust occurred in the early 2000s, it seemed as though there was just a shift, and we saw it here more than anything else. And it's funny, before that, when you talked about leverage buyouts, they really were leverage buyouts. Private equity wasn't really what it is now at the time. There were a few big firms that did it, but at that time, there was just a tremendous influx of talent and capital into the private market starting in the early 2000s. And we were lucky enough to be at a place where it was occurring. And one of the things I've observed is that there was a ton of talent that emerged from the Bass family in Fort Worth. They seeded a lot of ventures. You know, some of them were hedge funds, some were private equity groups, but a lot of that talent migrated to Dallas over time. And those groups, those firms grew, became clients, and supported really an ecosystem here of a lot of private equity groups in the mid-market and upmarket.
And of course, one of those firms, you know, maybe the most prominent being TPG.
Correct.
Talk about the institutionalization of the family office. Obviously, because of oil and gas, you've had extraordinary wealth creation in Texas for a century.
Right.
How has some of that wealth essentially been converted into things that look very much like private equity firms?
Yeah, it's interesting because family offices, when they first started to come into fashion about 20 years ago, they were almost side investments. And over time, family offices found, I think, if they were going to compete for private equity kind of investments, they had to compete for talent. They had to be institutionalized a bit in terms of how they compensated professionals, how people moved up. And it's just a different world now. You know, one of my larger clients is a family office, but they look and act like a private equity firm, except they have the advantage of not having definitive hold periods. They have, you know, there's no life of fund issues or anything like that. They've been very successful. They've become very large, and they have a great team.
And to what extent do family offices look to their lawyers to help them with that transition? And what kinds of guidance are they looking to lawyers for? Is this legal guidance, or is this more a question of how to build out the institution?
It's both, and it depends on the family office. You know, some really do want our assistance sort of soup to nuts on compensation issues, how to build a team, how to build the management structure, things of that sort. Others, you know, handle it a little bit more internally and just look to us for legal issues. It just depends on the group.
Talk about the evolution of your practice, really in the second half of your career, an increase in private equity work, for one.
Yeah. So continually, what happened when the dot-com bust happened and there was just an influx to private entities for private equity groups, especially here in Dallas, it just picked up rapidly. And I found, for me, doing private equity work was sort of a return to my roots, because one of the things I love the most about private equity work is that you're always dealing with a different business. There's a million ways people can be successful. And private equity groups are usually pretty agnostic about how they invest. There may be things they stay away from, but they're not industry specific unless they're laser focused on energy, for example. And so one day you'll be doing a deal in telecom. Another day you'll be doing an industry deal. Another one, it might be healthcare. But every transaction is different. You're dealing with very bright people. You're dealing with decision makers, and you're always learning a little bit about a different business.
One of the things that's happened in your career, certainly in Texas, is the differing paths of Houston and Dallas, in the sense that Houston has long since become the capital of the world's energy industry, whereas Dallas, it seems like, has evolved a much more diversified economy, you know, with a strength in middle market transactions. So talk about those differing paths.
I mean, you really hit it on the head. And I think it started in the late 80s, where there was the oil crash, and it was really difficult to do business in Texas. And I think each region or each city went a different direction. At that point, I think Houston decided that it would double down on energy. And at the time, maybe it was only oil and gas, but now fast forward 30, 40 years later, energy is not just oil and gas. It's solar, it's alternatives, it's electric. And Houston was able to become a city that became really the center of the world for talent of energy of all sorts, trading energy. I mean, it really became a magnet for that. And I think it's really driven the economy of the city. They've done great with it. I mean, it's just, it really has worked out well. At the same time, Dallas took a different tact. It took the tact of really creating a much more diversified economy. And some of this, I think, was happenstance, but I think some of it was intentional too. And you look at Dallas now, and there's nothing that creates more than 10% of our GDP, not one industry. It's really balanced. Yes, we still have some energy, but not more than 10%. But whether it's transportation, industrials, tech, it's just there is a huge amount of industry that just comes in all over the map, and a great and young talent comes here too. So it's really become a city that just is really poised, I think, for a great run for the future, great growth. You know, I look out my window, Bank of America's headquarters is going up literally 300 yards away. Another 500 yards after that, Goldman Sachs headquarters is coming up. It's going to be, I think, a great place for business over the next 20 years.
Talk about what you're seeing in your practice now.
We're seeing a lot more activity. Some of my partners, you know, I talked about this yesterday with them, and some are saying it's a little slower. But I think that when the Fed decreased rates, it was expected. And I think starting a month before that, I at least started seeing a lot more stirring, a lot more of the beginning of activity. And now that the rate cuts have come and people are confident that there's going to be more, I'm starting to see a lot more activity. The debt markets really are a lot better for M&A deals. You know, the decrease in interest rates really allows private equity buyers just a lot more flexibility. I mean, they live and die by IRR. And anything you can do to use one of the levers to increase that is going to drive transactions. And so we're starting to see a lot more stirring, I guess I'll call it. I'm starting to see more letters of intent. I wouldn't say I've seen transactions close yet quite as often, but we're definitely starting to see a much bigger pipeline of deals.
So at what point do you think this increased activity leads to more announcements? Will we see that, say, after the presidential election? Or do you think this is something we'll see more in Q1 of 2025?
I think before the end of the year. I think maybe after the election, but I think we'll see a lot of activity before the end of the year.
You mentioned earlier how rewarding it had been for you to practice largely with one core group of attorneys for the bulk of your career. Expand on that a little and talk about preserving that esprit de corps as you've moved firms and as you've developed in your careers.
As I mentioned, working with the same group of people has really been one of the things that has made my career rewarding and enjoyable. And we've all worked together. There's one gentleman that I've worked with every day of my career. Another three or four that I've worked with pretty much for the last 30, 35 years. And we stayed together through different firms. And we all seated the Dallas office of Catton together in February 2018. And there were 10 of us that did it. And now we're over 60 lawyers. And I think part of the reason why we've had the growth and success we've had is because of this tight group of people that we, I think it makes it much easier to show what a culture should look like when you have a group of people that have been together that long.
And then talk a little bit about your role as a managing partner of the office, how you think about that role, and how you thought about integrating into a larger firm when you moved over in 2018.
Yeah, I'll take it in reverse. When we moved over, integrating to the larger firm, you know, you always worry about that. And for us, it just wasn't an issue. The firm's practices at Catton mirrored our own. And so it was very easy for us to almost drop in and start working with folks. And one of the great things about a private equity, private M&A practice is that you find that you're always working with people in all disciplines all across the firm. Whether it's a large transaction, a small transaction, you're working with specialists, you're working with lawyers and other offices. So our integration was very organic and natural, and it's been terrific. And in terms of managing the office, you know, for me, the biggest job is to try to promote people coming up in the organization, give them a sense that this is a place that they want to be for the rest of their career. We don't want people to get great training, which they will, but then leave in a few years. We want them to become integrated with our clients, develop relationships like I've had the pleasure of doing with each other, and work here, you know, throughout their career. And that's what I try to do. I try to promote people and make them see, you know, the benefits of having a close group of people.
And then finally, tell us a little bit about what you do to decompress from the job.
I'm a grandfather now. And so part of it is my son's a tax lawyer at Weill, and my son and daughter-in-law and granddaughter all live in Washington. So I try to see them at least every 3 months. That's important to me. My wife and I are also very involved in the arts. I'm on the board of a contemporary art museum here in Dallas, the Dallas Contemporary. And so we try when we travel, at least if we go to any sort of a city, a good part of that trip is always dedicated to going to museums, going to galleries. We love to go to art fairs if we can fit one in when we go. And that's a big part of what we do to decompress. And I guess the final thing is, I'm a big baseball fan, and being from New York, the Yankees are in my blood. That's never left. And my son and I have gone to visit every stadium, and we just finished that last year. But since we've done it, new stadiums have been built in Miami and St. Louis, and so we want to go see those now. We'll probably do it with my granddaughter, too. We'll also go to Sacramento, I guess, when Oakland moves out, to see something there, and then, of course, Las Vegas, when that new stadium is built. But that's been really fun for me, and that's something we do together.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Great, thank you. Really a pleasure.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.